Well, good evening and a very warm welcome, one and all, to a rather late Dr. Brox radio show here on peoplesinternetradio.com. Tonight, in what's obviously going to be a slightly restricted length show, I want to think about, with the help of my friend Synchro, myth and story. It's been of some fascination to me for some time, as frequent listeners will know. I've been very impressed by the way some people tell stories on a stage. We've seen a group called The Factory, who work in their own clothes, using their own names, and any props they need, they grab off the audience, and they can be utterly convincing. They can really solidly draw you into a story, so that by the time you get to the end of whatever it is they're doing, you're actually seriously concerned for the people involved in the performance. And story and myth, I think, are important to us. We've been told by Santos Bonacci and many other, actually now assured sources, that nearly all of the myths and legends that we read from the Greeks and the Romans and probably the Norse and many other tales are all based on what was going on in the night sky, that they are in some sense a record carried down through the ages to tell us of things that happened in the planet's immediate neighbourhood. And so all of the characters and the gods and all that kind of stuff, they're actually representations of something which is information, testimony, if you like, from the past. And it's certainly true that once people had managed to decipher the Mayas language, they discovered a rich panoply of myth and story that ran from the distant past, right the way through to the modern Maya, who are still living and talking a version of the ancient language. And every single character in these myths and tales from central Mexico has a corresponding entity in the night sky. It might be the Pleiades, it might be the moon, it might be the sun, but one way or another, each of the characters that's presented has a reason for being there, and again, they're telling tales of the night sky. Well, our ancestors over here in Albion, they tell a different sort of legend. People may remember Serena Roney Dougal, when she was on the show, encouraging people to pay attention to what is known as fairy lore, the stories of the fair folk, because it seems that our local ancestors, rather than concentrating on the stars and the heavens and distant objects, chose instead to examine, in some sense, the development of the human entity itself, psychologically and in its relationships with the world. And so it is that we read stories of mortals, who living souls who walk this earth, having truck, as it were, with people from the underworld, lords and queens and ladies. Sometimes one of the fair folk comes and marries or gets involved with one of the people on the earth. Sometimes it's the other way around, and one of the earth walkers travels to the underworld to find out about the fair folk, and sometimes to live there. And it's said that when you disappear into these lands, you can be seem to be gone only for a few days to yourself, but you've gone for generations on earth. These two are fairly common stories around the world, and they're important to us because, just like the stories of stars and planets, they are, I think, an attempt to carry to us information about the nature of the way our consciousness relates with the world, and perhaps the way the world is as well. So we have legends of greatness and leaders, people like Arthur, who, despite being flawed and having all sorts of difficulties in actually pulling any kind of sense out of the world, it was an attempt to manage, as it were, living here. The tales of the fair folk concentrate on liminal spaces, which we'll be hearing a bit more about when we talk with Synchro, about strange half-worlds where the laws that apply in our everyday world are not thoroughly applicable. They're interested in boundaries. They're interested in, if you like, the dream time. And certainly Serena Roney Dougal believes that these stories have a direct relation to our own psychic abilities, that some of them are references to the way we think, to the way we've developed as a race, and to the way we've related with the planet that we live on. So, far perhaps from living with the idea that we're actually fixed forms, perhaps the tales of the fair folk and the ancient legends and myths that have actually come down in this country, in this area, tell us of things we've been in the past and things we need to remember. And as such, there are a lot of common themes. And one of the things I want to be concentrating on tonight is a tale which some of you will have heard, because Synchro performed it at the Green Gathering this year, The Birth of Taliesin, which is a very ancient Welsh tale that is thought to have existed, I think, for at least 2,000 years, even though it was only written down some 500 or 600 years ago. And one of the reasons why I want to concentrate on that is because Synchro's been looking at it for a while. Thanks for joining me, Synchro.
No problem.
And you've been, really, stories become quite important to you, hasn't it, since you started looking into Taliesin?
Yes, well, it's been an interesting process for me, because when I started telling The Birth of Taliesin a couple of years ago, or perhaps even 3 years ago now, I was telling it from a stance of really not knowing anything about what the story, the deeper meanings that are contained within the story. I had no idea. So coming at it from that innocence, if you like, and then through telling the story, becoming more interested in what it is telling us. Just recently, I've been reading a really fantastic book called From the Cauldron Born, by a man called Christopher Hughes. And the byline is Exploring the Magic of Welsh Legend and Lore. And it really is one of the most fantastic books I've ever read, because it's all about the tale of Taliesin and the archetypes contained therein. And I had no idea that there was such depth to this story until I read this book. I had some idea, and as you know, I've been talking about cauldrons and their significance for some years now, because I believe that whenever a group of people come together, they are making their own cauldron, yeah, which is particularly applicable to that group. And I've been saying, as a way of groups getting together, that every single person in that group is an essential ingredient of the wonderful soup that group is going to create together while they're together.
And of course, people who join the group for a while and then go their separate ways, their distinct flavour remains in the cauldron, doesn't it?
Yeah, yeah, they have affected the soup, basically. Yeah, yeah. So I've been talking about that for some time, and the cauldron, of course, is totally central to our tale.
And what about generally? Does Christopher Hughes have anything to say about the power of myth? Because you and I have both spent a lot of time looking at the work of Joseph Campbell, who's a bit of a global mythmeister, really, and is completely engaging on the subject. If anybody wants to find some Joseph Campbell, we've discovered there's a couple of sets of DVDs, which I haven't unfortunately got the names of to hand, but he is probably the most engaging individual I've come across on the subject of myth, although if you go searching on YouTube and stuff, you tend to find a lot of people talking about Joseph Campbell, don't you, rather than having Joseph Campbell himself. So what does Chris say about
he obviously rates Joseph Campbell as well, and he quotes from him several times in this book, and I'm delighted to see that. And, what he's got to say here about the... I'm going to be quoting from this book a bit, because he just says it so well.
Yeah.
The power of myth. The Celtic tales arise from a time when the islands of Britain had not been segregated into neat little parcels, perfectly delineated by borders and invisible boundaries. The old tales and legends were alive and thriving during a time when there was no such thing as England and Wales. Such concepts had yet to be invented. As a consequence, the tales continue to sing of a misty period in time, before the Romans came, long before the Saxons and Normans invaded, when we all shared the same language and relished in a common mythology based on the land and the relationship the tribe had with it. Mythologies act as keys to the lucid awakening of the spirit. Cultures the world over share a surprising commonality within their mythologies. In the British Isles, the similarities between the British and Irish myths are obvious. They share similar themes and contain identical traits and archetypes that have common attributions with their opposite cultural counterparts. Within these myths, it was generally accepted that a mere mortal, a simple human being, by a series of transformations, challenges, and initiations, could become the epitome and embodiment of wisdom and magic. According to the great mythologist Joseph Campbell, mythology is an organization of images metaphoric of experience, action, and fulfillment of the human spirit in the field of a given culture at a given time.
So what we're actually talking about here is far from being just stories. They're stories that are indicators of our own individual transformation and our potential in the world.
Yeah, certainly are. I think that quote there by Joseph Campbell deserves another read. I've read it many times already, and I think it's so good I'm going to read it again. It is an organization of images, metaphoric of experience, action, and fulfillment of the human spirit in the field of a given culture at a given time. And one of the things I've been thinking about for some time, but I've had a difficulty grasping, is the idea of archetypes. And they have interested me for quite some time, and they've obviously interested many people the world over. But what Joseph Campbell is telling us, and I believe it too, that the archetypes that we experience in our dreams and in the myths of our land are culturally defined. And this is something that has helped me to understand how these archetypes are expressed in a different way throughout the different cultures across the planet.
They are the same archetypes, though, aren't they?
They
broadly are. Speaking, it's just that how you see them varies depending on where it is you're looking
That's
at them
right.
from.
That's right. It's your culture. The culture that you've been immersed in is what defines the visual representation of your archetypes, basically.
Yeah. So, I mean, two of the best-known archetypes, just to give people a bit of an example, are the Animus and Anima, aren't they?
Yes.
So every male individual is thought to have a feminine archetype within them, which is different for every single individual because they're also formed by your own experience. The same thing applies to the women, doesn't it, that they have an Animus. So as individuals, you have a kind of counterpart to your apparent physical gender. Which you're working towards inside or modelling inside. And I think, because they're difficult things. There's whole books written about archetypes, some of which are pretty interesting, some of which are dead boring, in my opinion. But I liked, just in order to get a grasp of the idea of what one is, I had it explained to me by somebody who suggested that every baby that's born has the idea of what a mother is. It has to, in order to get to know her face and to be able to suckle and all of that. But when it's born into the world, it only has the archetype. It has this kind of, I feel like, a kind of basic idea, a sort of program that's running. But each time it suckles at its own mother's breast, each time it looks at her face, the archetype drifts more into the background and the mother in the physical world takes its place. So it is a kind of story of a transformation from spirit, isn't it?
Yeah. And I think everybody retains the mother archetype inside themselves, as well as adopting the mother archetype in your actual mother in the real world.
Yeah.
And I think having a healthy relationship with both is a good idea, if you possibly can, because to communicate with our inner archetype of the mother will help us in relationship with the outer.
Yeah. And this is these are the kind of characters through which these ancient legends tell themselves.
That's right. I mean, every single character, as he says, there's no padding out in these tales at all. They are very much to the point, and every single facet of these tales has relevance and meaning. Nothing is just there for the sake of it. So, and the fact that these tales have survived, some people think that the tale of the birth of Taliesin has been expressed all over the world in different stories, using different archetypes and different images, but the basic story of transformation that this story embodies, if you like, is global. And Joseph Campbell knew a lot about this, and people like him make me feel like I am just, I know I am, this is the tip of the iceberg in terms of exploring the meaning of these stories. I'm very much an amateur on this, but it is so fascinating to me. And I can learn so much from people like Joseph Campbell and Christopher Hughes that it's like a big door opening for me. And I understand now why it is so important that these tales are kept alive. Not only have they been brought to us down the millennia, some people think that this tale is 2,000 years old, at least, and that it came down through the oral tradition, being modified all the way, because that was key to the oral tradition, was that new learning and new ideas were put forward by the bards and the storytellers of that time. That's the only way we had to share news, and new learnings from maybe, who knows, the Orkneys would find their way down to Wales through the storytellers and the travelling bards of the time.
So there was actually a sharing of knowledge, which just strikes me as being something a bit different from our current patenting, peer-reviewed, copyrighted, secret your information.
You know, I mean, this is all that we had. We had no internet. We had no telecommunications. We had none of this stuff in that time, you know.
I think that's an important point. The telecommunications, the internet, the mass media, all these other things. It's, I think, important to bear in mind when we're listening to these old stories and thoughts about them, that we are being told a story now. And the story we're being told is nothing like the story of transformation and the empowerment of individuals and the dealing with archetypes and the development of the self. Mm. It's all to do with distraction and, if you like, the kind of the restriction of that sort of thing, it seems to me. And it's possible that these old stories had exactly the kind of effect, the motivating effect on the people that were listening to them, as the kind of stories we see coming out of EastEnders are having on the people of today.
Mm-hmm. Well, these storytellers, you know, they must have been really good at what they did, you know. They had the whole roundhouse in their thrall. They had a fire in the centre with a cauldron probably hanging over it with food for everybody to share, you know. They had everybody's attention because this was the only entertainment of the day.
And like I said, you've seen the factory. You know how convincing they can be.
That's right. You know, they are the storytellers of our time.
It is a kind of magic.
Mm. Yeah, it is.
So where does this story take place then, this birth of Taliesin?
Well, it actually takes place on the shores of Lake Bala, or Llyn Tegid, as it's known, in North Wales.
We've seen that, haven't we? We were lost.
That's right. Yeah. We got lost, but it meant that we could see Llyn Bala, or Lake Bala, or Llyn Tegid, as it's called.
It's big, isn't it?
It's apparently the biggest natural freshwater lake in Wales. It's about 4 miles long and less than a mile wide, I think.
But very deep.
Very deep, apparently. It was the remains of what's called a glacial cleft. So it's very deep. Christopher actually says it's unfathomable.
Oh, excellent.
But it's very deep. And, it's been there since the Ice Age.
And this story, the birth of Taliesin, is all set around that lake.
It is indeed.
Which to this day has clear drinkable water in it.
Apparently the water is very good quality, yeah. They have had that blue-green algae stuff in there in recent years, but hopefully now it's clean again.
Yeah. So we've spoken a little bit about the narrative spirit, haven't we?
Yeah. He's got a lovely little definition of that in here, actually. I'd like to give it to you because He gives three main reasons that these tales have survived. And we've mentioned a couple of them, but he just says this about the narrative spirit. He says, thankfully, a deep ancient relationship developed between the spirit behind the tales and the people to whom they were relevant. This is what is known as the narrative spirit. It is the living, inspiring, Awen-filled creative force that prevented stagnation and thus perpetuated the tales. It is the magic behind the words that fall from lips and rise from dusty parchment.
So different, having it told to you and performed rather than reading it.
That's right. And of course, he mentions Awen there, which we are going to be going to in a little bit more depth.
Yeah.
But basically, it is the spirit of inspiration. It's called the prophetic spirit. These stories are full of it.
Yeah.
In fact, the whole story is intended to imbue us personally with Awen, or the prophetic spirit.
Well, that's sort of been happening with you since you read that original kind of simple version of it. The deeper you get into it, the more inspired you become, it seems to me.
Totally. It's having that. It's interesting because I'm actually living the experience of the initiate, if you like. And I feel pretty enthusiastic to share this experience with other people because there's so much learning contained within what is superficially quite a simple story.
Well, like so many good stories, it kind of works on the level that you're able to understand it, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Because didn't you? Years ago, you went on a writing course, didn't you?
Mm-hmm.
On this subject, and you came across a bunch of people who were well up to their eyebrows in it.
Yeah. I realised then what a novice I was at the time. And although the tale attracted me to go on that course, I really did feel quite out of my depth.
Yeah.
And
I remember you being quite surprised, actually, by how far into it people were prepared to go.
And this was some years ago.
Yeah.
I discovered that before I started telling the tale and getting into it. In that way, yeah.
Yeah. And what about the bards, the people that told it? They must have been part of the survival of this as well.
They certainly are. There's some lovely words for...
We've spoken about... Fred Gillam was talking about the bards and how they had years and years of training.
Yeah.
To learn not just one story, but loads of them. And because there's information in them, it was important that they got them right. Although they were tuning them a little bit towards the local audience, towards the people they were performing for at the time, the basic information, the basic form of the story, it was important for them to get that right.
Yeah, I guess the stories must have been changing gradually over time with the changes in society, I suppose, and the culture of the time.
Yeah.
And they changed with the times
rather
than being fixed, which is what, of course, happens when things get written down.
Yeah.
People then start arguing about accuracy and, you know, stuff like that. But there's a really lovely thing here. He's been going into the word, the meaning of the word bard, and the Welsh for bard is bardd, and he describes the bardd as a transmitter of tradition and awen, an individual trained in the old traditions of storytelling and the dissemination of tribal wisdom.
Yeah.
So they are the newsreaders of the time, doing it with great craft and magic.
Makes a very interesting parallel with the newsreaders of today. It just makes me chuckle a little bit, that does.
There's another Welsh language meaning for the word bard. It was one I really love, and it's daroganwr. And this was a new word to me a few years ago. We were talking about Merlin as being Mab Darogan, or son of prophecy.
Yeah.
And daroganwr means prophet. And many of these tales contain prophecies. The prophecies of Merlin are very famous, and many of them contain prophecies that have already been fulfilled. There were prophecies about the flooding of the lake of Bala, of the lake there. And obviously some of those came true, because there is now a lake where apparently there was no lake before.
Those are expressed in some of these stories, aren't they?
As
the unwatched well.
That's right,
I love that. People, the well is watched, and it's watched, and it's watched, and then one night there's a bit of a party, and nobody watches the well, and...
Inundation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm also interested by the word prophet. What's the Welsh word again? It's lovely.
Daroganwr.
Daroganwr.
Yeah. Darogan is prophecy. Daroganwr is prophesier.
Mm. because I know the
Man of Prophecy.
The Maya made some really pretty stunning prophecies that seem to be being lived out, and that doesn't include the December 21st, 2012 one, which I gather came from somewhere else. But there are longer range prophecies by them concerning huge numbers of years of trouble that they were going to go through once the white man arrived, which is pretty much what happened.
Mm-hmm.
And in recent years, they've managed to regain access to their holy sites and to be able to start doing their own ceremonies there and things like that. And it reminds me of Serena's experiments with those monks, where she said, well, those, the guys that had done 40 or 50 years meditative practice would be 100% correct on precognitive experiments.
Mm-hmm.
That's not to say they knew everything that was going on or was going to happen, but perhaps if they concentrated on it, it certainly yields the possibility that that's the case.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the things that comes up in the Taliesin story, isn't it?
Yep.
Knowing all that is, was, and ever will be.
Yeah.
Again, a characteristic of the shaman worldwide is that he can see backwards and forwards in time, which is a characteristic of the prophet. So, you know, we should, I think, give these ideas serious thought, because these are the kind of capacities that these stories talk about, and these are exactly the kind of capacities that are being encouraged out of us by the technological world and administrated world in which we live, or at least that's the way it seems to me.
Well, yeah, we go into this just in a little bit. I'd like to go into that field that we access through the spirit of inspiration.
Yeah.
We'll just go into that in a minute. Yeah. But just one more thing I wanted to say about the bard. And there's another name for the bard or the storyteller. It was given the title of Cyfarwydd. Now, that's a very interesting word to use here. And literally translated, the term means the familiar learned one, which I really love.
I love the Welsh language. That's
everybody
great.
Is familiar with the storytellers because they'd be well-known people. So you would be expecting a certain storyteller to turn up at your in your village.
Kind of like Gandalf in Lord of the Rings turning up.
It would be.
Yeah.
You know, it could be, you know. So the familiar learned one. So it's suggesting they had a lot of knowledge, but they were of the people and the people were familiar with them, which I think paints a lovely picture of the bards of the time.
Yeah.
Not strange people that were feared, but familiar. But they knew a lot, and they were willing to share that information.
Well, once again, I'll draw a parallel with the factory. When they come to Penlanoli, they are a sellout every single time, and there is a real buzz knowing that they're coming. And you never know what kind of stunt they're going to pull either.
Yeah.
It's never the same thing twice. I mean, I know no theatre company is, but they're seriously experimental and seriously effective. So it's these skills, in a way, are still being practiced today. They take other people's stories and they make them real for you. And they're really good at being in a place for a couple of days, learning a bit about the lay of the land, getting a couple of local jokes together and that kind of stuff, so that the story they want to tell can be woven seamlessly into the environs of wherever it is they want to tell it.
Yeah. Yeah, there's people doing this, of course, all over the place now. There's a real resurgence going on in storytelling and the telling of some of these tales. And some people are actually steeping themselves in these tales in quite a deep fashion all over the globe. I mean, that's the thing I was going to say, that this particular tale that we're looking at tonight is just a vehicle for understanding the learning to be gotten from some of these old tales. You can just use it as an example. But it is a tale that is steeped in this land. It is a tale from the Cymric lands, this part of the British Isles. This tale is from here, this particular version of it. And that's the thing, is that other parts of the world had their own tales at different times that did the same jobs as this tale is doing for us and did for us when it was being told then. It's come down through the millennia to us. It can still do the same work. The magic and the transformation that's contained within this tale is as relevant to us today as it has ever been. And that's why I think it survived.
Mm. It's possibly even more relevant today, given the kind of tack it's got to compete with.
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, let's bring back the art of telling tales around the fire or around the dinner table after meals. Let's not rush off to watch the box or fiddle with some electronic gadget that's going to communicate, you know, with somebody else on the other side of the planet. I mean, lots of people want to do that, and that's fine. But let's do some of the other stuff as well, you know.
And that's another thing that I really enjoy is when people do get together, a few people who've got a few stories to tell, so that you can kind of take it in turns. It is really brilliant entertaining each other, and there are so many stories. I wouldn't mind getting into a bit of it myself, the storytelling. There's, I would have thought another, presumably the third reason why these stories survived was because some bugger did start writing them down.
Well, yeah, they started writing down from existing texts, it's widely thought, and that's what academia has come to the conclusion of, that it came down through the oral tradition, was written down in scraps and pieces, and then those stories were gathered together by the scribes of the 1500s, 1600s, and put into these manuscripts which are being preserved in the National Library of Wales in Aberystwyth to this very day. And apparently you can go and look at them on the library website, but I'm going to have to persevere a bit. I'd love to see the real thing.
You're hoping actually to get through the... get actually into the library, aren't
you? Yeah, I'd love to go because...
go and see the physical item.
I'm quite encouraged that the Welsh, in these old Welsh manuscripts, the Cymric language, the Cymraeg, if you like, is similar enough to what I can speak, although mine is quite a colloquial version of the language. My vocabulary is improving through reading these tales and some of this old poetry, but it's similar enough for me to understand it. So that gives me quite a thrill to think that I could go to the library in Aberystwyth, if I can get through the security, to go and see some of these old manuscripts and actually read some of this old Welsh in the old hand of the scribes of the time. That would give me a real kick.
Yeah. Yes. And I get, well, that's actually something that's happened across the world, isn't it? I'm aware from my own search for a kind of early human cooperative effort. You keep coming across a young, we'll call it a state for want of a better word.
Yeah.
But somebody who's really, really riding the wave on the board and hanging ten. They do, one of the things they do tend to do is gather texts from all over the world and have them translated into their own language.
Mm.
And so, and that's how information has been transferred to us. There's many texts which, because then the libraries almost inevitably get destroyed. The books and the papyrus and stuff get burnt or looted or whatever. But one way or the other, through this process, all sorts of things like geometry, knowledge of geometry and maths and loads of different subjects that are absolutely vital to us have been preserved and maybe only translated once and survived the burning of a library.
Mm.
But here we have a corpus of knowledge which is still there to be seen. It's a library that has not yet been destroyed.
Yeah.
Give them time, folks, give them time.
I mean, there is an argument to say as well that these tales came down through the oral tradition and they developed in that process. Once they were written down, they became fixed, and there's been a lot of exploration. There are scholars who are just focusing entirely on the Book of Taliesin, which were a collection of poems written down in the 14th century, I think.
Right.
The Book of Taliesin was actually written down. So these poems, some of them are really mystical and puzzling. And there are scholars working for years on one line of this poetry to explore its depth, it's amazing.
The poems themselves have a really rich structure, don't they? One of the things you've changed, we'll hear the new version of your story a bit later in the show, but one of the things you've changed is the spell that Caridwen casts over the cauldron.
Yeah.
And the new version of it is really lovely.
Yeah. Yeah, I want to bring this concept of Awen into the tale as I tell it. And that's really important. So we're going to go into this in a minute, aren't
well,
we?
Well, why not? Why not have a chat about it now?
Okay.
Because Awen, divine intoxication, sounds like a good subject to me.
Yeah, well, the whole story is based, we should just give a quick summary of what it's based on. And it's based on the fact that Ceridwen and Tegid, her husband, have two children. One is a beautiful daughter and the other is an ill-favoured son. And she wants to brew a magic potion to transform her son and fill him with the prophetic spirit, or what's known in Welsh as awen. And it's pretty impossible to translate the word awen, but many people have tried. And it's been called wisdom and the prophetic spirit, the divine flow of spirit. Apparently in the Welsh dictionary it's down as the poetic gift, genius, inspiration and the muse.
Or in a way, though, we are all the kind of the divine flow of spirit, aren't we? That's what we are, an energetic wave from the...
We are. We all have the potential to be filled with awen, the gift of inspiration. Mm. You know, not everybody feels inspired all the time. There will be moments of inspiration. I mean, we're told that Mozart apparently downloaded a whole, was it a symphony?
Yeah.
In 6 seconds or something?
He was certainly very young and he could write it all down.
Yeah. And it just came to him, apparently. Mm. And I would call that inspiration.
Mm. Signed a lot of scientific ideas of a rainbow right that way as well.
Inspiration or in dreams, mm. Indeed.
Yeah. And all the religious texts rely a lot on the idea of visions and dreams.
Yeah.
Being informative.
Yeah.
So, informative.
So you could describe awen as an eternally moving stream of energy. Or like a candle flame. Because there is a continuity, there is a quality of continuity in awen. But it's also constantly changing, like the candle flame. Although it's a candle flame on one candle, it's never the same candle flame twice.
And you can take David Bohm's example. He was always fascinated by the vortex the water makes when it runs out of a sink.
Yeah.
Realizing that, that the vortex wasn't, well, it was a thing in itself, but it was actually made up of the water that was flowing through it, and the water was always different.
Yeah.
So we might say that that the water that's enfolding the vortex might be regarded as a kind of metaphor for awen.
Indeed, indeed. He has a very nice little description of it here. The act of bringing forth awen can only realistically be expressed through our creativity, where we access the vast cauldron of potentiality and make manifest what was previously unmanifest.
Now, that's brilliant.
It's gorgeous, isn't
it? That the act of bringing forth awen can only be realistically be expressed through our creativity, where we access the vast cauldron of potentiality and make manifest what was previously unmanifest.
Yeah.
Well, that covers so much stuff. I mean, we're both fortunate. We do get to do the kind of manifestation thing through artwork and drama and music and all the rest.
Mm-hmm.
And I know my own personal experience that something that you draw or paint yourself has a fascination for you that no other art can really have, because it's come from outside of you, and also because what you do will not be the same as anybody else. And I think that that's another thing that's seriously missing from many people's everyday life, is time to be creative. You know, time to build your own stuff, time to have a table in the kitchen that you made, or a vase that you made, or a painting on the wall that you did. I think many people certainly I never had any time for it before I kind of stepped off the treadmill.
And if you do get involved in something absorbing, something which absorbs you, like painting or drawing or whatever it is, gardening, walking, it can be anything. If you do get involved in something like that, the time takes on a different quality, doesn't it?
It does. Time's really plastic when you do things like that. It can really stretch itself out.
And that, in my opinion, is when you will be totally in touch with awen, or the spirit of inspiration, if you like. Time goes out the window. You're just with whatever it is you're doing, and it is completely your focus.
Yeah. Your focus is on it, your intent is upon it, and it's not just time that disappears, it's all the other ideas that are being constantly visited upon us.
Your head empties, and you become totally focused on whatever it is, the flower of life or the hair or the painting of a sunset or whatever it is you're focused on becomes your total focus. And that is, I think that time is really good for us and very special to have a bit of that quality of time in our lives if we can.
And you're kind of moving closer to the world of story by doing that, aren't you?
Yeah. Yeah. There's this great book that, again, is in the Aberystwyth, in the library in Aberystwyth, which contains a lot of this really cryptic, and I think he calls it satirical poetry, which couldn't probably ever have been written by the same person. But it's all in this book called The Book of Taliesin. And some of it is so mystical and strange. I'd like to read a little bit of it for you, if I may, in the Welsh and the English. And I'm going to read the whole thing in Welsh.
Yeah.
It's not in short, it's only five lines long.
Yeah.
But just for you to get a bit of a flavour of it.
Give this a listen as well, folks. The Welsh, this ancient Welsh that is so beautifully written is many, many people, and I'm included, find it absolutely fascinating just to listen to it. And it is very close to our own ancient root languages, and it is a language that not so long ago would have been spoken right from the west coast all the way across to the east coast before various various teams of invaders came and hunted all the nonconformists into the west. It's a beautiful thing to listen to, even if you stand very little chance of understanding what it's saying. But fortunately, I'm sure you'll get some kind of translation afterwards.
Yeah,
although that is difficult. Translating Welsh into English, they're emotionally, energetically, completely different things. They deal with the two languages, deal with subjects in completely different ways, which makes it actually sometimes quite comical. quite comical translating the Welsh into English.
Yeah, it can sound very clumsy, the English, yeah. Can't it?
So, but is this the spell? What's this?
Yeah, this is from the Book of Taliesin. It's a part of one of the poems from the Book of Taliesin,
yeah.
Basically. There's a bit more of it at the back. But I hope the pronunciation is correct, because it is different from the Welsh we speak today, but it's similar enough for me to have a good idea as to how it was said. I'll do my best. And it says, Awen aganav, o duvin is dagav, awon kit berit gogun agurhit, gogun pandienu, Gogun pan dilenu, gogun pan dillid, gogun pan wesgrid, gogun pet pegor, a seed a dan vor. And the translation of that, I'll try again. He's done this. Awen I sing, from the deep I bring it. It is a connected river that flows. I know its might, I know how it ebbs, I know how it flows. I know its course, I know when it will retreat. I know what creatures there are beneath the sea. I mean, it's pretty cryptic.
Well, most poetry is pretty cryptic, because what I've heard said is that prose is the best words and poetry is the best words in the best order.
Yeah.
It is people trying to reach for a kind of ineffable experience they've had and write it and communicate it in such a way that other people stand some chance of grasping what's being said. We're actually really lucky still to have the Welsh language to hear, because there was quite a substantial attempt to obliterate it.
Yeah.
And then suddenly they all turned around and now they're saying you've got to learn it.
Yeah. It's gone through a bit of a turnaround in my time here.
Yeah.
But it says here that the above piece of poetry creatively expresses Taliesin's embodiment of Awen in a manner that demonstrates its all-pervasive, omnipresent quality. It exists simultaneously in all things, in all places, at all times. It is not bound by the laws of the physical universe, for it exists beneath the fabric of the known, visible universe. So it underlies everything,
yeah.
This spirit of inspiration. And it's up to us, and
it's quite quantum, isn't it?
It is, very. I mean, it's up to us whether we access it or not.
Yeah. And, of course,
it doesn't happen automatically.
And we are being distracted from accessing it.
That's
right. Something that we're constantly glancing off on the Dr. Rock show,
yeah,
is that that there are many, many solutions available to us, and some of them are without doubt metaphysical,
yeah,
which is what we're talking about, yeah, here, really.
On this book, the tale itself is about initiation, and the whole book really is about the message that there will be no conscious initiation into the spirit, to tap into the spirit of an inspiration or Awen, unless we put the work in.
Yeah.
And this tale uses the power of our cultural archetypes to enable us to follow that process, to fulfill our access to Awen, or the prophetic spirit. Call it what you like.
Yeah.
I'm trying to get it across so that people have some idea of what it is we're trying to access here.
Yeah.
And he says, initiation is required to be conscious of Awen, as the tales and poem recount. And he said in the, again, from Hanes Taliesin, not the book of Taliesin, it says, Akana arodeiniodd hi drwy gelfyddydd llyfrau fferyll i ferwi pair o Awen. And that means, so she took to the crafts of the book of fferyll to boil a cauldron of Awen. So she set out to do this.
And fferyll, it's an interesting word, isn't it?
It is.
A chemist?
That's
alchemist,
right.
Yeah.
If you look up, I only noticed this the other day, but if you look up at the chemist on a street in Wales, it will be called the Fferyllfa. And this is the book of fferyll, which is a book of spells and potions and a book about healing, basically.
Yeah, yeah, well, the only difference there is that that one's a book about healing. The rest of it is a matter of spells.
Yes,
and,
but they've pinched the name of the book of fferyll,
yeah,
it seems to me, to,
yeah,
put on the drugstores of our streets of today, yeah. And also, in the same manuscript, the poet further elaborates that he says, Mi agefais awen o bair Ceridwen, which means I received my awen from the cauldron of Ceridwen. In fact, it's not my awen in the Welsh, it's I received awen from the cauldron of Ceridwen. So
what about Ceridwen's cauldron then?
Well, let's get on to it.
Let's deal with our cauldron before we deal with Ceridwen herself,
yeah,
shall we? Is that the, do you think that's the right order to do it in?
Well, there is an order to this, and we start with Ceridwen's cauldron.
Yeah.
And then we go on to look at the characters in the story in this kind of order,
yeah,
before we get back to Ceridwen.
Mm-hmm. Fair enough. Perhaps I'll tell you what, before we do Ceridwen's cauldron, before we get into the story and,
yeah,
start looking at some of the things it's trying to address, why don't we have a bit of music?
Yeah.
I can't actually hear the music. This end, my laptop's gone completely quiet, so I'm going to try playing some. Let's just have five or six minutes of music, couple of tunes. I'll give everybody a chance to go and get some tea or open another hobgoblin or whatever it is they're doing. I think we'll kick off with the Pogues, Jesse James from that cracking album, Rum, Sodomy and the Lash, which strikes me as being a pretty fair description of what's going on right now. You're listening to Dr. Rock's radio show on peoplesinternetradio.com. And that was a friend of ours. That was Fee and her friend Sorrel over there in Spain performing as Las Favoritas and playing a tune called Bad Things. So there was a bit of genuine Welsh behind that one. And we're talking tonight about myth and story, about the myths and stories that were told to our ancestors, just as we're being told myths and stories now, and looking at some of the ideas that were being made common in ancient times in Wales and are currently being overridden, and it's one of our tasks here to start bringing this thing back to consciousness. If nothing else, the importance of storytelling and the story of our own personal transformation, because that's basically what these tales are about. And all of this happens in a cauldron. Can't we just feel that we're living in a cauldron with all the people mixing it up and coming up overall? What we've got when we look out into the world is as a result of all of our own personal activities within the cauldron. And as we change, so the contents of the cauldron change. So what about the cauldron in the story? Cauldron is a massive, everywhere in the world, the cauldron is a pretty central image, isn't it?
Mm.
As a kind of container for change.
Mm. Yeah, if you were playing word association and you said the word witch, probably, I don't know, 99% of people, this is the next word they said would probably be cauldron, because they're interlinked so closely in our myths and stories. You hardly ever get a witch without a cauldron. But it wasn't just witches that used cauldrons, because in the times when people were living in roundhouses in the Iron Age and the Bronze Age, and when the central hearth was where everybody gathered and where all the food was cooked, it was everything, you know, and it would have been probably hanging on chains when they had the metal to do that over a big fire.
So actually in the physical centre and the metaphorical centre.
Yeah, yeah, the cauldron was the centre of the home, the hearth. And the attention of everybody went to the cauldron. And it was the way hosts demonstrated their generosity, and everything came out of the cauldron. Everything that had gone into the cauldron came out in a different form and fed everybody. So everybody was sharing the same food from the same pot.
That was one of the things I liked about the Tribal Love Cooperative. They had that great big pot that the food came out in. Yeah. Everybody was eating out one dish there too.
That was a cauldron, you know. The wonderful chef was getting all those lovely ingredients in and turning it into something really fantastic.
Nick Nomick said, "Kitchen witch cooks a mean stew."
There you go. There you go. So in our story, the cauldron itself is really central. It's the primary archetype of the tale. And I've only just really realised this, but of course it's true, that archetypes can be non-anthropomorphic as well as anthropomorphic.
I.e. not given human characteristics.
Yeah. So most of them will turn up in our dreams as characters, but we will also dream about the sea, about the edge of the sea, about mountains, about various kinds of landscape, which are also showing us archetypes. Mm. And the cauldron, the physical cauldron itself, is an archetype because it contains everything. And in this case, what it contains is the essence of the transformatory experience. Because Ceridwen, we'll go into her a little bit more later, but she is the creator of the magic potion which will imbue the person who drinks it with the prophetic spirit, or Awen.
I'll have some of that.
Yeah, I mean, it's great stuff. And it's also the symbol of the feminine as the womb or the receptacle for the essence or spirit of life.
Yeah.
So it's a very powerful motif, archetypal image that everybody has within them. Mm. To access, we all know about the cauldron, basically. We were born in a cauldron, and we were given birth from the cauldron.
Oh, the bugger's turning up the heat.
Yes. You know, so we were birthed from the mother's cauldron. And in Welsh, there's two words for cauldron, beautiful words, I think. One is crochen, and one is pyr. And the word crochen shares the first part of it with the Welsh word for womb, which is croth. So crochen and croth definitely have a very close connection. And again, we're told in the Book of Taliesin, there's a line in the poetry where Taliesin says, "Mi agevais awen o bair Ceridwen," which means, "I received awen," or inspiration, "from the cauldron of Ceridwen." You can't get much clearer than that.
No.
Really, as to...
Well, where else is it going to come from? You know, if the because it's a representation, isn't it, of the kind of the cosmic cauldron in which everything is boiling up.
Yeah. Yeah, it is.
So that's where else is inspiration going to come from?
Well, exactly. Yeah.
And also, I suppose it comes from the fact that you've got all of these different elements all mixing up and creating something that's completely new.
Yep. Yeah, this is a unique brew that is made by Ceridwen for her son to transform him. What she doesn't realise is that plans aren't going to go quite like that. But we'll go into that in a bit. That interestingly enough, I realised, looking at the story in a bit more depth, that there are three cauldrons in the story, and that is the physical cauldron that holds the magic brew that is going to imbue the drinker with the prophetic spirit. There's the ingestion into Ceridwen's womb as a grain of wheat in the story. So that's the second cauldron in the story, where there's a period of gestation before Gwion Bach is transformed into something completely different, not yet called Taliesin. And
so he's kind of travelling from kind of consciousness to the womb and unconsciousness and back out again and coming out transformed.
That's something that's really common throughout the stories of the Mabinogion. The cauldron is a popular motif, and quite often there's a period of gestation within the cauldron before rebirth can occur.
Yeah.
And that in the famous cauldron of rebirth from the Mabinogion stories, the dead soldiers were thrown into the cauldron. They were reborn the next day, and they had to spend 24 hours inside the cauldron. There was a period of gestation before rebirth could happen, and when it did, they were dumb. They couldn't speak, so they were alive and they could fight, but they couldn't relate the experiences they'd had within the cauldron, which I thought was quite interesting.
Well, that's quite uncannily sort of like things seem to be, isn't it?
Well, quite the opposite happens in this story, of course, because he goes through there's the physical cauldron containing the brew. There's Ceridwen's womb, where the grain of wheat is transformed into a baby boy.
All could become clear when you hear the story later in the show, folks. Stay tuned.
We should have done that at the beginning. In Ceridwen's womb, where he's transformed into a baby boy. And then there's the coracle, or the known in Welsh as the bol croen, or the skin belly, or indeed womb, where the baby Taliesin is put to be floated out into the sea. So those are the three cauldrons that are within our story.
Serial transformation.
Yeah.
You can't get away with just one.
Yeah.
You know, each experience is going to throw you into some sort of mayhem by and large, and you'll come out the other end.
That's it.
Better informed, and all that does is just gets you ready for the next transformation.
And it just helps us to understand what a central thing this cauldron, this image of the cauldron is, you know.
And it is making the kind of change where you might imagine moving from caterpillar to butterfly, except that what he's doing is he's going one step beyond butterfly. We don't even think about what comes after that.
Well, again, the chase is a very famous and magical part of the story, I think, and we'll come to that in a bit, won't we? Well, when we hear the story, we'll hear that part of it again, because it's all about transformation.
So that's the main thing. That's where all the action takes place. That's where the potion's going to be brewed. I remember Tamach, when he was on the show as well, he made a connection between the cauldron and the cauldron that's used to brew ayahuasca and other similar visionary brews throughout the world.
Yeah.
That does also, under some circumstances, appear to lead to a degree of the prophetic spirit.
Yeah. Indeed.
So one of the common characteristics, it seems to me, of our the legends of Albion are that they deal with the world of shadow as an equal, that they actually recognise that as individuals, everybody has the light and shadow within them.
Yeah.
And that that having truck with entities in the underworld is a common theme in stories of the fair folk and the rest.
Yeah.
And that again is I think something that perhaps is worth thinking about, because we're not necessarily encouraged to be sympathetic to the shadow in the world in which we find ourselves, are we? In fact, by and large, what tends to happen is a vision of the shadow in whatever form, you know, might be the Nazis, might be any political party, might just be corporations, the bankers, they're a good one. It's the bankers, they're to be shunned, they're to be slagged off, they're to be, if possible, all of that. But in fact, the shadow is totally crucial to us, isn't it?
Yeah.
And it plays quite a big part in this tale.
It does, and the shadow or darkness is represented by Ceridwen's son, who is called Morvran and becomes known as Morvran Avagdi, which means something like Sea Crow of Utter Darkness, which I love,
yeah.
And or Sea Raven of Utter Darkness, because he was such a dark character, they had to give him a new name. And he represents the shadow in the story. He also represents the shadow within us, because this is a story about our own transformation. We are the initiate who is experiencing the archetypes and the learning they have for us in this story. So there's a lot about there's a whole chapter about the shadow in the book. And we can only, you know, we can only touch on it here, basically.
Well, oh dear, it's just to give people a flavour of the story. Yeah. And the story.
The point of it all is, really, is that we need to bring our shadow to the cauldron, just as we need to bring our other characteristics, because everything must go in to the brew if it is going to be effective and work for us, because it is a part of our initiation to recognise the shadow within. And to work with that shadow, to transform it.
Absolutely brilliant. Reminds me of that phrase of a friend of ours, Juliet, that our job here is to synthesise the light and shadow within.
That's right.
Absolutely right.
Which brings us straight on to Morvran's sister, who is called Creirview.
She'd been excised from the original version of the story, hadn't she?
She had.
She wasn't there. You thought, well, she's not doing anything.
That's right.
We'll just leave her out.
Who am I to decide that one of the major archetypes of this ancient story should be dismissed?
Well, so, you're the authority, mate.
Had to bring her back in because, and there's a quote from Hannes Taliesin, and they had a daughter named Creirview, and the fairest maiden in all the world was she. So she is the epitome of beauty and light and fairness,
and
in contrast to her twin brother, yeah. Morvran,
yeah.
Who is the epitome of darkness.
Yeah. I was going to ask if they might be twins.
I think they are.
Twin siblings are really common, right over the world.
Even if they weren't, it helps our story to imagine them as being born at the same time,
yeah.
And being so contrastingly different from each other, because that's what they're for,
yes.
Is to contrast. And really, we know that there is no light.
They have all opposites.
There is no light without the shadow, without the darkness.
Yeah.
And that that if you bring a lighted candle into a dark room,
It'll light the room up. You strike striking a darkness match.
But if you put anything in between the light and the wall, you'll get a shadow.
Yeah.
So there is always shadow where there is light. If there's anything there at all, there's going to be a shadow, isn't there? So, we need to bring them both to the cauldron, and we need to harmonise them. And combined, they bring immense magic to the cauldron. Apart, they can destroy it. Together, they teach us to listen.
Well, you see, once again, the idea that, to a certain extent, your own challenging aspects of our own personality, shall we say, need to be addressed and worked on. Again, I remember Tomash said that the communities he'd been in, they keep going so long as people are working on themselves, so long as people are making sure that they're kind of interacting fully with the people around them. And being honest and always working for progress rather than letting stuff kind of build up inside.
Mm. Yep.
And that when people stop working on themselves, basically the community stopped working properly. So that it's kind of actually working on your more difficult aspects, realizing that if there are flushes of chemicals running through your body that are making you angry, jealous, any of those other things, then the situation is at least 50% yours, and in order for everybody to be moving on in understanding and with any kind of real progress, then a degree of communication is necessary on that kind of subject, bringing your shadow to the cauldron.
Yeah.
Not to spoil the taste of it for everybody else.
Well, it's essentially your cauldron that you're brewing here. You are the initiate, and you have to put the work in.
Yeah.
Although in the story it's Ceridwen who makes the brew, it is actually Gwion Bach that does the work of tending and stirring the cauldron throughout the the tale. So he's the initiate who represents us in the tale,
yeah,
who's putting the work in.
Yeah.
We've got to put the work in. He talks about this in the book quite a lot and saying it's not spirituality or connection to spirit is not something that comes from a store or that you can pay £200 yeah. for a course to go yeah. and pick it up. It is yeah. something that you have to put the work in yourself. And
that's really true of the dealing with the administrative framework, it seems to me, that if you just let it get on with it, it's just going to keep raping you. And if you want to stop that from happening, then a good degree of work and study is necessary. But yields results.
Yeah. Yeah, there's another great quote from Joseph Campbell here, hero. He says, about making your vices work for you. Don't give up your vices. Make your vices work for you. If you are a proud person, don't get rid of your proud. Apply it to your spiritual quest.
Yeah.
So basically, look at the qualities that we contain as individuals and develop them and use them to our advantage in our quest.
Mm.
We're all on a quest.
Yeah.
You know, of a kind. So, yeah. That's Moravan Avagdi and Creirbrud.
And his beautiful
radiant twin sister. And the reason why they're both there is to illustrate the importance of integrating the light and shadow within.
And that goes for all opposites. It also probably is making a statement that there is actually a unity between all opposites.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, really we need both in their totality.
Yeah.
Balanced. Mm. We need both.
Oh, balance, yeah, we see a lot of that nowadays.
Just saying, yeah. And then, of course, we have, it would have made sense to hear the story first, perhaps, but then we have, in the story, we have Ceridwen's husband, Morvran and Creirbhiu's father, who is called Tegid Voil.
So he's got the same name as the lake that it all happens round.
Yeah, well, don't know whether the lake was named after Tegid Voil or whether Tegid Voil was named after the lake, but it's quite likely to be the former,
mm-hmm.
because this tale is well steeped in the landscape there.
Yeah.
The legend of Ceridwen and the birth of Taliesin
yeah.
is of that part of the world, basically. It's from there.
Mm-hmm.
So it may well have been named after, because he was a nobleman
yeah.
who existed. Tegid Voil yeah. was an actual nobleman known in history.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
Yeah, he did. And he represents nobility and strength, manliness, noble god-type figure, energy of the Lord. And he is the authority, stability, and the setting of boundaries. So he represents the physical world in the story. He is the provider, whilst Ceridwen does her stuff, brews magic potions and gets involved in all her crafts. He keeps the family together. He provides for the family. Yeah. He also represents the structure of the cauldron, which holds the magic brew for transformation.
Mm-hmm.
So he is boundaries and structure. And
so presumably partially at least representative of natural forces and all the other things that run around any given situation.
Yeah.
Giving it form.
Yeah. And the physical and the spiritual cannot be separated whilst we are within human form. They are not destined to do so. So basically they're saying that although Tegid is only mentioned very briefly at the beginning of the story, his presence is there throughout.
Mm.
That's the same, just true of Creirbhiu as well. She's only mentioned once
yeah.
as Morvran's beautiful sister.
Sort of but in the narrative cauldron, isn't she?
That's right, and the archetype still exists within the story because yeah. you've planted it at the beginning.
See, this idea of the spiritual cannot be separated from the material effectively whilst we're in physical form, I love that idea because, of course, everything is, we now know that everything's vibration. It's quite possible that you can kind of keep looking down levels of, you know, from molecules to atoms to particles to subatomic particles, that just down and down and down. And so everything is effectively a frequency as well. So you can't really tell where spirit and matter begins in quite a literal sense.
Well, This is apparently what a lot of the people who are working in these fields actually practicing and, investigating, researching these stories in some depth and working with them in a ritual fashion this very day, in this day and age that we're in right now. These people believe that it's not really ascension or getting away from the physical that we need to engage with. While we're here on this planet, we need to be engaging with the physical, but keeping ourselves open to accessing inspiration, the spirit of inspiration, while we're still here. You know, like we say, we're here to experience the physical world in all its fullness.
We're here to ride Harley Davidsons and play Fender Stratocasters and drink beer.
That's it. We're here to do all those things. But we're also here to explore the spiritual dimensions of life on Earth while we're here. It's not about going somewhere else.
No.
That's not what we're talking about here.
No, be in the 3D.
Yeah. And transform in the process. Learn and research and find out about this stuff so that we can actually live that transformation in our lives.
Or indeed any kind of transformation.
Any kind of transformation.
All the information we're getting, all the learning we're doing is constantly transforming us.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, I guess we've got to talk a bit about liminal spaces, aren't we?
We are indeed.
You know, that's where we all are, in a way. We're all, you know, but the rabbit hole's a really good example of a liminal space. In fact, it's a place that you go into where you find out things that you just had no idea about before. And they change you never think the same again.
Yeah, that's right. Well, liminality apparently comes from the Latin word limen, meaning threshold. Mm-hmm. So any boundary or threshold between one physical place and another, or one mental state and another, is liminal, and I think it's a beautiful word, and it contains liminality, which is the place betwixt and between. So any gate, doorway, boundary wall, any of those things represent a liminal space, which is betwixt and between. A really well-known one that often turns up in dreams is the boundary between the sea and the land. And I think that's a particularly interesting one, because with the tides, the boundary between sea and land moves. And, you know, your footprints disappear and all those wonderful things happen.
Particularly good liminal space to think about, I guess.
That's right. You can walk along the beach, look back and see your footprints, and then 10 minutes later they're gone, you know.
I guess it also applies to time, does it? So to seasons, to midnight and midday, you know, the zenith and all of that.
Yeah. Midday, midnight, all the turnings of the year are liminal spaces. And, of course, a lot of people celebrate those turnings of the year. The solstices, the equinoxes, and the quarter days, and they're all liminal times where we can access the, if you like, the other worlds or the spiritual dimensions where the veils are thin, and we've all heard those.
That period just before you go, just as you're going to sleep.
And that's a really famous, I say famous, a lot of people perhaps do it without thinking about it, but if we spend time in the going to sleep, and in the waking up, those are really powerful liminal spaces where we can access other realms, you might say.
I think the majority of psychic experiences apparently happen in that state.
Yeah.
You know, precognition, seeing a dead person, that kind of stuff.
Yeah. So, yeah, Morda in our story, if you like, represents... He's the key to liminality in our story.
And he's the guy that stokes the fire under the cauldron.
Yeah, and he's also blind. And one of the reasons why he represents liminality in our story is because he's taken out of his ordinary existence, as is Guillaume Bach, to tend the fire beneath the cauldron. And he's also blind, so he doesn't live quite in the same world as the rest of us. And that puts him into a semi-permanent state of liminality.
Yeah.
And in that sense, he is acting as a warning to us that liminal spaces are to be honoured and respected and learnt from and accessed consciously. But to stay there would be dangerous because we need to have this interaction with the physical world and maintain a healthy physical presence and not get lost in liminality, basically.
Keep some boots on the ground.
That's it. Keep your boots on the ground. That's really what Morda is representing to us there. And then we get on to Ceridwen, who is, it's called, this chapter on Ceridwen is fascinating, and it's called In Search of the Witch Goddess. And in our story...
Witch Goddess, that's great.
Yeah, well, that's what she is, of course. Any self-respecting witch anywhere in the world today will know about Ceridwen and will probably honour her and her archetype as, a very early, if not the first witch to be, she's known as the queen of witches worldwide, basically. And this story has travelled all over over the world by now. It's broadly known.
Yeah.
So she is a powerful archetype in and of herself. And although she is very human within the story, she also embodies the aspect of goddess. So we relate to her because of her humanness, because she doesn't get everything right and she gets angry in the story. But she is also very learned in the arts of magic, witchcraft and sorcery. She has got a copy of the Book of Ferelt, which she can consult, and she knows how to brew the magic potion which will imbue the drinker with Awen, the poetic, prophetic spirit. So she's very wise and very learned, and some people fear her because of her knowledge and her skills, but she stays human to us.
A bit like Granny Weatherwax in the Terry Pratchett books.
Yeah.
The mistress of headology.
Yeah.
And undoubted kind of queen of witches who is respected and kind of feared in more or less equal measure.
Yeah. Yeah, this is what Ceridwen represents. Yeah. And I've changed it in the story because I was saying old witch, and Ceridwen isn't represented in the manuscripts as an old witch. So I've changed it to the wise witch, or the Awrach Doith, because I don't want to set her in any particular age group.
Yeah.
She is a wise, learned
Well, she's
witch.
A mother rather than maiden or crone.
Well, exactly. She's in her childbearing years. I mean, she's given birth to Morvran and Creirview, and they're growing up. We imagine they're somewhere around late teenage or something like that. I don't know. But she gives birth again in the story.
Yeah.
So she's not an old hag. That's not what we're dealing with here. We're dealing with a fertile, youngish witch goddess. So it's her aspect as mother in the tale that is put forward quite very strongly, because it's her love for her son, who is very, very ill-favoured and not particularly nice to look at. She is inspired to transform him by creating a magic potion. She works really hard to bring this about. She devotes herself to it for a year and a day.
I wonder how often this is the story with mothers and first sons.
Who knows? But there's obviously quite a powerful link between mothers and their sons one way or another.
Yeah.
And she wants to transform her son. So she puts all this work into creating this magic potion to do it. And as we'll hear in the tale, it ends up somewhere else.
Yeah. Well, shall we play the tale?
Is it time to play the tale?
We can play the tale.
Yes.
And then,
let's do that.
Finish off Ceridwen.
Let's do
that. And have a look at Gwion Bach, who is the symbol of our transformation, really.
Yeah, he is the initiate of the story.
Yeah. So we'll just try and find our way back to the broadcaster. And we'll put on the latest version of Synchro's telling of Taliesin. It's there's a lot in there. It's a sort of, it's 12, 13-minute little tale. And we'll come back to you after a bit of music after that, I would think. But this one contains the old spell, the ancient Welsh, and the new edition of the beautiful twin sister, and all the other things that we've been talking about. And we'll be back with you shortly. Here's Synchro's Birth of Taliesin, with robins in the background.
Long ago, before the Romans ever came to this land, there was a man, a nobleman, known as Tegid Voile. Tegid lived on the shores of Lake Bala, or Llyn Tegid, in North Wales, with his unusual family. Ceridwen, his wife, was known as her Wrach Doeth, or the Wise Witch. She was very skilled in the arts of magic, witchcraft and sorcery. She was a powerful healer, but people were wary of her because of her special powers. Now Tegid and Ceridwen had two children, twins. One, a beautiful daughter named Creirvew. She was as bright and as fair as a summer's day. But her brother, Morvran, was more like a thundercloud. He was so dark and mean that Ceridwen and Tegid renamed him Avagri, meaning utter darkness. And Ceridwen was very concerned about her son, Morvran Avagri. How would he ever win favour at court with his mean thoughts and dark looks? What could she, Ceridwen, a Wrach Doeth, do? And she had an idea. She would find a magic spell that would give her son clear sight, poetic majesty, and knowledge of all that was, is, and will be. She would need a very powerful spell indeed. So she took down her ancient magical book, known as the Book of Ferisht, and scoured it for 3 days and 3 nights, until she found it, a magic potion that would give whoever drank it clear sight, poetic majesty, and knowledge of all that was, is, and will be. They would be filled with Awen, or the spirit of inspiration. So Ceridwen brightened with enthusiasm for her new purpose. She ordered the blacksmith to cast a massive cauldron to hold her magic brew. She stole a young boy named Gwion Bach to stir the cauldron. Day after day, night after night, for a year and a day. She forced an old blind man named Morda to tend the fire beneath the cauldron. So as Gwion Bach stirred the potion, and Morda tended the fire beneath the cauldron, Ceridwen searched the countryside for the right plants and herbs to make her magic potion work and transform her son. As Gwion Bach stirred, and Morda tended the fire beneath the cauldron. Ceridwen, a wrach doeth, often chanted this spell. Awen aganav, o duvin is dagav, buriav hyd ar y crochan hwn. Awen I sing, from the deep I bring it, may magic to this cauldron come. Awen aganav, o duvin is dagav, me daw doethineb trwy'r hyd hwn. Awen I sing, from the deep I bring it, may wisdom from this magic come. Awen aganav, o duvin is dagav, morfran fydd trwy rym yr hyd, y dyn doethaf yn y byd. Awen I sing, from the deep I bring it, morfran will be the wisest man in the whole world. After a year and a day, everyone was dog-tired. Morda, the old blind man, was so tired that he'd fallen asleep by the side of the cauldron on a pile of logs. And as Gwionbach still stirred the potion, he could hear Ceridwen and Morvran Avagdi snoring from where he stood. As he stirred, the liquid in the cauldron started to bubble and hiss. The cauldron started to crack. And at that moment, at the very moment when the potion became ready, three drops, the only three magic drops in the whole brew, flew out of the cauldron and landed on Gwionbach's thumb. Gwionbach swallowed the potion, and in that moment he became wise and had knowledge of all that was, is, and will be. Gwionbach had become so wise that he knew he had to hide. When Morvran and Ceridwen came rushing towards the cauldron, it split and cracked with a wrenching scream, and the now poisonous liquid oozed and bubbled away. Ceridwen knew straight away that her magic potion had gone, and she was livid. At first she thought Morda, the old blind man, was to blame, so she struck out his eye with a log. Morda, now double blind, told the woman that it was Gwionbach that had stolen her magic potion. Gwionbach knew that he had to flee from Ceridwen's anger, so he fled. He ran as a hare. She chased him as a hound. He swam like a fish. She sped through the water like an otter. He flew as a small bird. She hunted him as a bird of prey. Exhausted, the small bird dove down to a pile of winnowed wheat in the barnyard and became a grain of wheat. Ceridwen transformed into a big black hen and ate that grain of wheat. Nine months later, Ceridwen, a wrach doeth, gave birth to a beautiful baby boy. She had determined, when she discovered that she was with child, to kill the baby when it arrived. But when she saw him and his beauty, she couldn't bring herself to do it. But Morvran Avag Dhi said, "That Gwion Bach stole my magic potion. He must die." So Ceridwen took the baby and sewed it into a bol croen, a small coracle, and put it on the waters of the lake to meet its destiny. Some say that it was 40 years later that Elfin and his men were waiting patiently at the salmon weir of Gwyddno Garanhir for the large catch of salmon that was sure to be theirs. They waited and waited until finally the tide returned to the sea. But Elfin and his men were mortified to find nothing but a sea-soaked leather sack at the bottom of the weir. Where was their fine catch of salmon? But Elfin decided to investigate the sack. He waded into the mud, picked up the sack, and opened it carefully. And inside, what did he find but a beautiful baby boy? Well, Dunna Taliesin. And that's how Taliesin got his name, meaning radiant or shining brow. And then the baby began to speak and told the story of his birth in a poetic tongue. Elfin and his men soon realized that they'd found something far more precious than fish. So Elfin put the baby into his saddlebag and rode home to show his father his wonderful catch. But his father was disappointed. A baby? But then Taliesin began to speak in a poetic tongue and amazed the old man. He told Elfin and his wife to take great care of this special baby, and they raised him well.
Oh, that was Synchro and her latest rendition of Taliesin, the story that we're talking about tonight, in an effort to try to bring people's minds the transformative efforts that are going on just by being here, by being this mixture of spirit and matter, wandering as a living soul incarnate. And, of course, I think there's all manner of magical transformations that can be gone through. I certainly have been amazed at the transformation of the world as a result of the people I've been listening to, the work I've been done, the reading I've been doing over the last 3 or 4 years. My perception of the way things are working around me has completely changed. It is an amazing and real transformation in real time. It's very empowering, and I think all transformations are really covered by this particular story. But Gwion Bach obviously is the centre of the thing, isn't he? He kind of he's transformed as a result of the output of the fire and the cauldron into something that's just wise enough to run away. And then after 40 years or so, he is possessed of Awen, as we talked about at the beginning of the show.
He is. He's the initiate of this story. And the initial quality that we're presented with about Gwion Bach is that he is an innocent. And it is an interesting position to be at the beginning of a... it's the only place to be at the beginning of a quest for inspiration and transformation, is that we need to reset our factory settings, if you like. We need to go through a difficult initiation to open ourselves, to reset ourselves back to our original, what would you call it, the primary essence of life.
So we need to kind of rise to the challenge rather, being your wallflower or...
Well, you know, it takes all sorts to brew a good cauldron. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's room for all types and everybody has their niche. But what we have to do using this story is to put the work in to brew our own magic potion, which is only applicable to us. And to do that, we have to bring all aspects of ourselves to the cauldron.
You so, think it's Matt? It is to a degree stepping up to the plate and taking responsibility, isn't it?
It is. That's exactly what it is.
Taking the wheel.
If you want to make a change, then we often hear said and say that the best gift we have to offer the world is our own personal transformation. And I do believe in that as it's a motto, if you like. Mm. And that's something that's worth working towards, because if it's the only gift we have to offer, we might as well try and do it the best we can, you know, give it our best shot. You know?
And in truth, if you want to be making favourable changes to the way the world treats you, then your own transformation really moves you towards that.
That's right. And this is a vehicle. This story is a vehicle for that transformation, basically.
It's a kind of obscure how-to manual.
Yeah. It's not even that obscure when you look at the symbolism and the archetypes contained therein. It's actually quite simple.
Yeah.
But what we have to do is put the work in. That this isn't going to happen to us. It's going to happen because of us and because of the work we put into our own transformation. And Gwion Bach represents that in the story.
He puts a year and a day of stirring into it.
He does. And some of the manuscripts imply that Gwion Bach is actually employed by Ceridwen. In my telling, I say that she stole him, because I quite like that idea, that she stole this young
Stealing
boy.
Stealing innocence? Surely that doesn't happen.
I don't like it, but I like it in the sense of the innocent boy being taken from her home and not chained to the cauldron, but basically made, committed to stirring this cauldron for a year and a day without respite. They did this all night and all day for a year and a day, grabbing bits of kip whenever they could. So this was a full-time job, yeah. So Gwion gave himself to it, and really what we're told in the story is that when the magic potion became ready, there were only three magic drops in the cauldron were magic.
That's another interesting thing, isn't it, that the... That you need all that cauldron of stuff to get just the three magic drops.
Yeah.
And the rest of it's poison.
Yeah. Yeah. And really, the way I see it is that the rest of it became poison after the three magic drops had jumped out.
Mm-hmm.
Because until they jumped out, they were contained within the whole liquid.
Right.
But they chose, if you like, the spirit of inspiration, the Awen that had been brewed in the cauldron, chose its time as to when it jumped out of the cauldron. It's been a year and a day. Morvran and Ceridwen had got their timing a bit wrong, but also, as we heard in the story, the liquid started bubbling and hissing and the cauldron began to crack. The liquid itself had decided that it was time for the inspiration to jump out of that cauldron. And jump and land on Guionbach's finger. He was the innocent at the beginning of the tale, but he was also the boy that put in most of the work to the stirring of the brew and the tending of the cauldron. And so the essence, the three magic drops, he'd earned them by the time they jumped out of the cauldron and landed on his finger. They were his. So,
and she does end up being, he does end up being Ceridwen's son.
Well, that's a really, really interesting turn on the story, because she is making this brew for her ill-favoured son, Morvran Avagdi of Utter Darkness, and it doesn't work out that way. So that's another way that in which we can relate to Ceridwen as a human, as another being like us, because she gets it wrong. Mm. But in the end, as you say, she gets it right, because although it's Guionbach that's ingested as a grain of wheat into the belly of the black-crested hen, it's born as another being. But it's not yet Taliesin, although some of the manuscripts mention that when Ceridwen's waters break, when her cauldron bursts and that baby comes forth, that he already has a shining brow. But I personally like to put that with his birth out of the skin bag when Elphin finds him, because that's when he's had the 40 years at sea before being found by Elphin and his men.
It's taken him 40 years to be transformed into Taliesin.
That's from what was left of Guionbach after the transformatory chase. Yeah. In which both Guionbach and Ceridwen had to suspend their human qualities to go with the chase. Yeah. And I think it's quite interesting, because Ceridwen was really angry that she'd been impregnated by the seed of Guionbach from the grain of corn. She was well livid by that, and she intended to kill the baby when he was born, but she couldn't bring herself to do it. And again, it was the mother's love that enabled the spirit of Guionbach, now contained within a new baby, to be put into the skin bag, to be set off to meet its destiny and not kill it.
And you've got two more kind of very common mythical ideas there, haven't you? Because effectively the chicken becoming pregnant by eating the seed is a kind of immaculate contraption, isn't it?
Of a kind, I guess. You know,
And also the the being put in a bag and lobbed into a coracle and sent out onto the lake or wherever it was, that also is something that we hear in many, many other stories.
Yeah, we've seen that all over the world. There are stories of babies who should have been killed but were given reprieve and put into a boat or a leather bag and sent off to sea to meet their destiny. So she gives Guionbach a chance to be reborn as Taliesin. Because she knows by now, she knew straight away that Guionbach had ingested the three magic drops. So she knows that he's filled with Awen, with the prophetic spirit. She knows the power of that potion that she spent a year and a day making for the purpose of transformation. She can't see all that work going to waste now.
And she doesn't have to.
She doesn't have to. She puts him off on the water and off
he
goes.
I like that, because she put the effort in and everything. And you can never tell how things are going to work out. And it really did look like the whole operation had gone, you know, pear-shaped. And it all kind of worked out all right. I quite like that sort of happy ending.
Yeah. And she actually, Ceridwen, takes an active part in Guionbach's transformation as well. And this is another interesting aspect of the story I hadn't looked at before. And that is, in the chase, the Ceridwen is the apparent aggressor in the chase, because she's the one who's pushing Guionbach to transform from the hair.
She's always bigger than his.
She's always bigger than his, and I thought about this, and I think it's because he is less experienced. He's had less practice. He has just been initiated and bowled completely, had his mind blown by being filled with the spirit of inspiration, or Awen. He has just been given knowledge of all that was, is, and will be, and it's blown his little head off. So he needs time to ingest that. But he moves from the hare to the fish to the bird and into the grain of corn through the elements. We haven't really got time to go through those here, but it's a very elemental story.
Yeah.
And fire being the transformatory energy that forms the other elements from which all the other elements are formed. So fire under the cauldron, the fire
of... And then he becomes the sort of earth, air and water.
The radiant brow is also described as fire in the head, and inspiration is also described as...
It's what Taliesin means, isn't it?
Fire exactly, it's radiant brow or shining brow.
Yeah.
And it is also, his radiance is coming from the area of the third eye or the pineal gland. This is not an ordinary baby that has been given birth to. This baby has been born full of Awen. And it's another lovely image that when Guionbach drinks the three magic drops, he loses the white of his eyes. His eyes become completely black. And it was said of Caridwen as well that the whites of her eyes didn't show. They were completely black. She was so full of the skills and the craft and the knowledge. And he becomes so full of Awen that it turns the whites of his eyes black. Yeah. Completely overwhelmed
and
by
so,
the...
So he gets poetic majesty, knowledge of all there was, is and ever will be. And what's the other thing?
Clear sight.
Clear sight. And that's one of those goes with each of the three drops.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Well, that's the way I like to think of it. I mean, past, present, future, all in one moment. You know, it's all kind of, that's the moment of inspiration. Yeah. So he's, the initiated is bombarded with information, completely blows his mind.
I think a lot of people on PIR will understand the initiate is bombarded with information. That's one of my experiences of going down the rabbit hole.
Yeah, and you know, many cultures all over the world have initiations that are quite difficult, where the initiate has to go through the tunnel full of crocodiles or... You know, you've got
has to be buried up to his head in sand and have ants crawl all over. Yeah, we've seen loads of them.
All over the world. They've got these really difficult initiations. But
it'd be nice to have a good, honest society that actually did that to you and gave you a chance of surviving it and then walking off.
Yeah. And another initiation common all over the world is spending time in darkness.
Yeah.
Some people do this for 3 days, 5 days. I know somebody who's just embarked on 3 months of darkness as an initiation.
I can imagine that being
personal,
a really powerful one.
Yeah.
I'm not sure, 3 months in the dark.
Some people do darkness workshops in this country and probably all over the world where you can go and spend 3 days or more in total darkness with a group of people and you learn about the kind of communication that happens when there is no speech, in total silence and total darkness with a group of people.
You don't talk either.
I don't think so.
Right, I can imagine that being a pretty transformative experience.
I mean, some people go and get themselves buried, apparently, but I personally have had enough of that in the desert. I think once is enough in this life.
Each to his own.
But some people go and spend time in underground, in boxes to experience the initiation of darkness, you know.
Well, we've got a bit of a left field question from Mahat. He asked it a bit earlier. I don't want to forget to ask.
No.
So he's put, if it's not too off topic, what does Synchro think of the tale of Owain Glyndŵr slaying the last dragon in the land of Denby, or
Dimbuch,
hence the town's name? How much truth does she think there is to it?
Well, to be honest, is it Mahatma?
Yeah.
I haven't looked into this tale, so I can't really say. I'm very interested in dragons, so I'll follow it up, and I would like to know more about Owain Glyndŵr and his ventures, but as yet it's not something I've looked into.
Owain Glyndŵr was thought to be a historical character.
He existed. He was a lord and a king.
Same set of Taliesin, isn't it?
Well, that's a very difficult subject, actually, because what we seem to have, and I've got some notes on this here, actually. What we seem to have is a lot of these manuscripts mention Taliesin. He's mentioned as a bard who existed in the 6th century, and what Christopher says is basically There may have been a bard in the 6th century who called himself Taliesin, or who adopted the name of Taliesin. And what he says is that really he sees it as a rank that you became a Taliesin, if you like.
Right.
And he's got a lovely little quote here, which I'd love to read to you. It is my belief that the name Taliesin is, in fact, a rank that may be bestowed on any individual who subscribes and is an initiate of the Celtic mysteries. It simply refers to the shining light of Awen that beams from the forehead, the third eye region, and is the fire in the head that burns from the wisdom of ages. So, a Taliesin would have been perhaps any bard who was full of the spirit of Awen or inspiration, might have been called a Taliesin. And there's many links between Taliesin and Merlin as well. And many people think that it may be the same spirit that inhabited the Taliesins and Merlin.
Yes, well, Merlin's Welsh name was Emrys Ben Isle, wasn't it?
That's right.
Radiant brow.
Yeah, there's a quote in here about that, but I probably won't find that just now. But, what we've got in the Book of Taliesin is, on the one hand, we've got loads of poems that allude to being composed by an actual 6th century bard.
Yeah.
And there was one called Taliesin, but there may have been many others. And others of these poems appear to be of totally mystical and legendary origin that surpasses the lifespan of one individual.
That's often the case. I mean,
it's the same with Homer.
And lots of others. Some people even say it's true of Shakespeare, heaven forbid.
Yeah. Taliesin was many people, and many of them were inspired bards of their time. I think more or less we can say that.
In closing, it has to be said that rather bizarrely, in as far as these tales were written down, which has brought them all the way to the Aberystwyth Library for kind of examination and stuff.
Yeah.
It was because they were written down by monks.
Yeah.
Yeah. Some of whom tried to presumably tamper with it. But
well, this is my argument for people who say that they don't trust the telling of these old Welsh tales because they might have been tampered with. Well, to be honest, it's quite easy to see whether they've been tampered with by people of a Christian persuasion, because they would be different stories. And they have even seen on the manuscripts where words have been erased and new words have been written in, they can actually scrub that out and see what was there beforehand on some of these old things. And yeah, some people did try to bring Christian imagery and words into the tales, but you can soon sort them out and see them.
Yeah.
It's perfectly obvious when a story's been Christianised, and you can un-Christianise it quite easily.
And do you reckon there were people actually in these monasteries whose job was to maintain?
Well, I love to think that
those infiltrators.
Yeah, basically. Whether they were people who'd been, you know, planted there to keep these stories alive and in as true a form as possible, or whether they were people of an apparently Christian persuasion, and we're talking about a very young Christianity that was mixing a lot with the old religion of this land. So there was a lot of crossing over and to-ing and fro-ing going on at that time. So some of these people may have become inspired by these tales, as Christopher Hughes thinks, and that were inspired to keep them true to form and bring them down through the ages.
Yeah.
So who cares? They came to us. That's the most important thing, you know. I've got a lovely little... Can I finish with this?
Yeah.
I've got a lovely little bit of poetry here. It's actually in English, but it gives us a taste of the poetry from the Book of Taliesin, and it's a description of a snapshot into Taliesin's birth. Just gives us a taste of how cryptic some of this stuff is. It was not of a mother and a father that I was created. My creation was created for me from 9 forms of consistency, from fruit of fruits, from the fruits of the first God, from primroses and from flowers, from the flowers of trees and shrubs, from earth, from the soil, was I made. From the flowers of nettle, from the water of the ninth wave.
Ah, oh, very good. Yeah, like you say, you can't beat a bit of cryptic poetry. Actually, I've really enjoyed that conversation. Thank you very much. And basically, I'd far rather have a story about individual empowerment and transformation than the kind of dross that's being forced on people kind of widely. And Christopher Hughes' book, From the Cauldron Born, Exploring the Magic of Welsh Legend and Lore. I look forward to probably reading it myself, actually.
But, really excellent book.
Perhaps in closing, last time you did your Taliesin story, we had the poem about what he is. I'd like to hear that again, if you could do
I'll
that.
I'll do my best.
We'll play a bit of music.
I'll do my best. In the rock, alive I would be hewn from it, like a dream of stone, like Merlin, my brother in the hidden place. A feather in bright air, I drift in memory's disguise, shadowy as sunlight shaped by sea. Half in, half out, I am reborn. I am in the wood, I am in the stone, I am in the sun, I am in the dancing, I am in all things. This is my discovery, this my strength, this myself.
It's just about it, I reckon, for another night. And thank you very, very much for Synchro to coming on and talking about that. I think, yes, it can be a thoroughly different world. I can quite see why she's got herself lost in story. I myself have been luxuriating in reading a bit of fiction recently, first time for ages. And it's good to get into a bit of story because, like I say, a story is what we're being told. And the guys that are telling it, I suspect, are every bit as skillful as the old bards were, but I don't think their information's anything like so useful.